Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 359, part two. I hope you all had a lovely Christmas and enjoying this nether region. That's not the term I wanted. This kind of period in between Christmas and New Year that just kind of lingers and you don't know what day it is. Well, you don't need to know what day it is. All you need to know is it's Distraction Pieces podcast day. And I've got part two. I mean, part one, many people have agreed with me, has been the best episode of the year. And part two only gets stronger, in my opinion. So you're going to love this. Rather than going over to my Patreon, over at my Patreon, you've got 12 free video episodes and all sorts of other stuff. And over at speechdevelopmentrecords.com, you've got jumpers, you've got t-shirts, you've got all sorts of things. Rather than going to any of them, if you're sitting there thinking, I fancy getting a bit of a getting my spend on, look at a load of the charities who need you more than ever at this time of year. But this year, Shelter and other homeless charities are great examples, because I did a homelessness podcast a while back with a few great charities 3 years ago, I think. If you just search Distraction Pieces homeless special, you'll find it all. But this time of year, homeless people see the most charity from the public. And that's wonderful, but it's also tough, because in reality, in the UK at least, in January, in February, it's actually colder than in December. But people have their charity moment because it's Christmas and then move on. Obviously, a lot of people won't have been having their charity moment this year. They won't have been having their walk home and see a homeless person and give them money when they wouldn't normally, or give them more money than normal or whatever. So if you can go out of your way to donate and help people that need it, then that'd be awesome. My Patreon ain't going anywhere. The merch isn't essential. The Patreon isn't essential. There's other things that are far more important. So yeah, anyway, I've rambled on long enough. We're going to wrap the year up, guys. We're going to round the year up in just two parts, and this is part two. So this is part two of the 2020 roundup. Obviously, I'll be back next week with the Films of the Year podcast, as always, the first episode of the year. I've also got some fantastic guests already recorded for next year, and some special bonus episodes for you as well. So yeah, let's wrap the year up. This is me and Blind Boy on the Distraction Pieces podcast. As I said, before we get on to the all of the lockdown stuff and the pandemic stuff and some election stuff, one thing that I wanted to, you may not have seen it, but I wanted to ask, a film I saw just before lockdown started was Calm with Horses. And it's an Irish film.
Fantastic.
And I just thought it was absolutely amazing. And I'm doing my Films of the Year podcast, and I wanted to get your kind of thoughts on that, because to me, it just told this amazing story. But I'm also aware that I've not experienced rural Ireland in any great depth. So I wasn't sure if it was, you know, basic or whatever.
I know the film. Let me double check the fucking author's name now. It's Colin, because I read that as a short story before I saw it as a film.
Really?
Colin Barrett. So yeah, it's from a collection of short stories by Colin Barrett.
Yes. And then Nick Rowland took it on and directed it. And yeah, just amazing people all around.
And so I'd read the short story and I'm like, wow, this is incredible. It's that, do you know, man, to be honest, rural Ireland, just think of a town in the north of England that used to have a mine.
Yeah.
You know, it's that type of thing. It's something used to happen here and now it doesn't happen anymore. And now a lot of people are just standing around and there's quite a bit of generational trauma too.
Yeah.
It's that feeling, and there's quite a high level of silence and a high level of suicide and a high amount of tension, and the things that matter are very focused on this small space. Like, I come from Limerick, which is, it's a city, it wouldn't be a city by British standards, like it's only 100,000 people, but it's a city by Irish standards, and it's the same shit. It's that small town if you can get out of Limerick, then you've made it. If you stay in Limerick, then people are like, you haven't made it. Huge amount of suicide, huge amount of addiction. The film absolutely nailed it. It captured the acting in it was fucking fantastic.
How do you feel Cosmo's accent was?
Perfect.
Because I felt it was flawless. Because weirdly, you gave me a load of advice on Irish accents once when I was auditioning for an Irish character in a Deadpool film. And I was DMing you and you were giving me loads of good little dialect tips. So watching Cosmo, I was like, to me, that seems flawless. So I was keen to, yeah.
I'd give it 99%. It really, really, there was only one or two. I tell you what, I was about 40 minutes into the film. And I was like, who is this Irish actor? I've never seen this dude before.
Yeah.
You know, and I work in TV, surely, because I knew Barry Keoghan, of course.
Yeah.
And I'm like, who's this dude? And then I found out because he's not Irish.
Because everyone else was at some point in Love, Hate. Every great exactly. Irish actor at some yes. point popped up in yes. Love, Hate, even if it's right at the end, or like Barry, or anyone else. So yeah, I can understand. You're like, where's this guy come from?
He nailed it. It's perfect. And I was then talking to Colin afterwards about the, because I'm looking at getting my short stories, trying to see about getting them turned into either a TV series or whatever. I'm in that early development. And I was speaking with Colin about, you know, who were you working with? What was the process like? Because the director and the screenwriter, it's one of those rare occasions when watching the film was exactly how it was in my mind when I was reading the short story.
Yeah.
So they completely nailed it. It's a beautiful film. It's fantastic.
I love it. I love it. Well, you know, so the other things in March, so Italy were the first to quarantine.
Yeah.
And lock down. Tom Hanks and Rita Wilson getting corona seemed to make America take it seriously, which is a bizarre thing that it took.
Yeah.
The granddad of America kind of thing to make him go, oh, hang on. This is real. And he got it in Australia. So you'd been out there at that point or just before.
He got it in Australia, yeah. I just left. This is going to sound dark, but it's a shame that so many of the celebrities that got it got such mild versions of it.
Yeah.
I think that was very poor PR for coronavirus.
Yeah, I completely agree.
It was good. I remember when Idris Elba got it and Idris Elba's wife got it as well. And he was doing his updates. And he just got a really mild version of it. And it was good for my anxiety because now we didn't know what this thing was. So there was a point where I was really terrified of this thing. And then when I saw, Tom Hanks was in hospital a little bit, but I don't think he needed to be. I think the disease was so young that they kept him under observation. But then Idris Elba got it and he's like, I'm at home. I've got the sniffles. It's fine. I think a lot of people saw that and didn't take it as seriously.
Yeah,
I mean, the one person, there's a singer called John Prine. John Prine died from it.
Wow.
So, but he wasn't public about it. John Prine was a country singer. I mean, our entire, not only our understanding of the fucking coronavirus, man, but our entire understanding of diseases has changed so much in that time. Like, I remember being in London in March, and it was about a week before Britain had officially taken it seriously. And I remember thinking, if I just don't touch anything, I'll be okay. And now we're in December and I know that science has shown touching things really isn't that important.
Yeah.
You have to cover your face, that it's transmitted through the air. So what it's done for us as a society, I think here's one thing, and this is I did a podcast on this. So I remember growing up and whenever I saw Japan or China on TV, I was always struck by news reports and you'd just see people in the subway and one or two people were wearing face masks.
Yeah.
And this was a thing growing up that I associated completely with Japan or China. And I always remember thinking, fuck me, that's strange. And I knew it was because of disease. I knew that was the reason. But here's the thing, and it comes to individualism versus collectivism. So in Britain, Ireland, US, we live in societies which are individualistic. As a whole, we tend to think of ourselves and what we can get for ourselves. Whereas in a lot of Asian countries, they're collectivistic. They tend to think not so much of themselves as individuals, but as part of a community. Okay.
It often also comes down to countries who have religion. And again, I'm not saying that religion is a good thing, but we've seen it so much in the Western, less religious world, or the version of Catholicism that fits with our everyday lives.
Let me take it back further.
There's far more individualism. Yeah, go.
I'll take it back further. So when I used to see people in Japan wearing masks as a kid, I used to watch and think, wow, those people must be very hypochondriac. I used to think that they were wearing masks so they wouldn't catch something. Because from an individualistic culture, I'm worried about what can I catch off someone? Whereas in Japan, it wasn't, I'm not worried about catching a cold. I have a cold and I don't want to give it to someone else.
Yeah.
But my individualistic way of looking at myself and the world wasn't going there. And they did an anthropological study. Basically, cultures whereby the staple food is rice tend to be collectivistic. And cultures whereby the staple food is like wheat or potatoes are individualistic. And the reason is, in order for a village to grow rice, it requires everybody to chip in. So everybody must, you can't just grow a little bit of rice out your back garden for yourself.
Right.
Everybody must collectively work on the rice paddy to create enough rice for everybody. So everyone must collectively put effort in. And cultures and countries where rice is the staple food, they tend to be collectivistic in how they think. But then in cultures whereby you've got potatoes, wheat, things like that, individualism is how we tend to think about ourselves.
Wow.
And even in Japan, and there's certain like mental health issues and stuff that are unique to the West that you don't get in the West, but you do get in Eastern countries as well, because mental health issues come about not necessarily the human brain, but how we as individuals relate ourselves to society.
Right.
So there are certain disorders that are in Japan that you wouldn't find in Britain or in Ireland or America. And it's just, it's individualistic versus collectivistic. So Asian countries, when it comes to put on a mask, why? So that you don't give it to someone else. They've had that shit nailed for years. But for us, it's been a huge issue. Why wear a mask? Trying to get people to think, wear the mask not for you, but for someone else. And if the other person wears it too, you're doing it for each other. We had to change our entire mindset to get to that space now. You know what I mean?
It's fascinating because, again, an example on my notes in March of individualistic kind of outlook. And it took the individualistic mindset for the Brits to start taking it seriously. So Boris spoke about, look, I've been in hospitals, I've been hugging people with coronavirus, I've been shaking hands with people with coronavirus. Now, what we should have been outraged about there is the risk he's taking for everyone else.
Yes.
He's spreading it around a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
That's mind-blowing. But people kind of, as usual, there was outrage, but largely laughed it off a bit because it's Boris. What made it hit home is when he then had to be hospitalised for coronavirus.
Yes.
And that's individualistic. That's us going... Oh, we could get that. It's not us looking at, well, he was doing all this hugging and stuff. He could have spread it and we don't know about it. It's gone, he's been doing all this hugging stuff and he caught it. Therefore, it could affect us and we all have to be more careful. And that's a perfect example of what you said there. The outrage and shock should have been, even if he didn't catch it, he could have spread it. But the outrage and shock came when he was hospitalized. And again, I think it's good. You spoke about people getting it badly. I think it's good that he got it quite badly and had to go into hospital and had to be... Again, I don't want anyone to die to get a message across, but it was good that someone had been so casual about it. Was then, and again, I genuinely think it affected, at least briefly, his outlook on things. Because when he spoke about it after he'd got over it, he seemed to be a bit more, man, you know what I mean? We need to do this seriously.
And
I think
that
changes
right
because
is...
I think, again, the powers... Same as I was saying about the president, the prime minister isn't actually as powerful as we like to think. So I think when financial issues and economic issues took over, it went back to being, it'll be fine. But I think initially, I think it hit him more as well to kind of go, right, we need to lock down properly. We need to wear masks. We need to be stricter on all of this. And
But that's one thing. It's one thing that always fascinates me about Britain is post-war Britain is this lovely jewel of socialism, right? Like if you think of something as like the NHS, like when the NHS was founded in, I think it was like 1940 something, Like the opening document of the NHS is a beautiful document. It appeared in papers, and it's just like, tomorrow your National Health Service exists. And this means that everybody, no matter how much money you have, is going to get free health. And for this to happen, we're all going to have to pay a little bit for it.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful document. But the conditions for something like the NHS to happen, and we said the wide-scale building of council houses, I think it's because Britain, for the first time ever, because of something like the Blitz, had become aware of, oh, fuck, we nearly got annihilated. We almost lost to the Germans. We almost lost. And that shock of individualistic fucking pain made the British powers, the rich people in power, go, maybe we should try a little bit of this socialism stuff. Maybe everybody should have healthcare. Maybe everybody should have housing. Because if you look at the history of council housing in Britain before World War II, the first ever council houses that were built in Britain were in 1919 by Neville Chamberlain. And it's like, I love the concept of council housing. I love the idea of being able to give someone a house if they can't afford it. I don't think anyone should go without housing, healthcare, or education if they can't afford it. I think everyone should have access to these things in a compassionate society. And if you look at the history of it in Britain, so in 1919, what happened was the military did a survey of the health of its soldiers' performance in World War One, and quite a lot of English soldiers in World War One came from like the poorer parts of London or poor parts of Liverpool. And what they found is that English soldiers were less healthy in combat than their German or French counterparts because they grew up in squalor, in slums, with very poor nutrition. So Neville Chamberlain, what took the first council houses was to be built wasn't an act of compassion for people who were living in slums. It was, how the fuck do we get better poor cannon fodder for future wars?
You know what I mean?
Which is, it's one of these things as well. I always remind, if ever I speak in my podcast about Irish history and the historical fight, we'll say, between Ireland and England and England, English occupation in Ireland, I always say, hold on a second, this isn't about English and Irish, this is about power structures. Because the very wealthy elite of Britain didn't give too much of a shit about the poor people of England and Britain either, no more than they give a fuck about the poor people of Ireland, you know what I mean?
Yeah, or you did some fantastic shows about it that were on iPlayer,
all my BBC,
I believe I watched them. Yeah, your BBC stuff, and that was looking at housing and kind of the structures of capitalism and how disgusting it is. So
I went around the richest part of fucking London, man. That was my Blind Boy's Guide to Housing. You'll get it on the BBC Player. Blind Boy Undestroys Housing. It's on the BBC iPlayer right now. And yeah, I went around this area in London called Billionaire Row, which is quite close to where all the embassies are. And there's all these buildings that are worth like 60 million and no one lives in them. And when you trace the money, so much of it is like global criminal money. Like in these areas where you've got the embassy of Morocco, embassy of there, you've got these other buildings, no one living in them, falling apart, and you can't trace the money. It's all shell companies.
Yeah.
And it's effectively huge money laundering for usually Eastern Europe and people trafficking.
Wow.
Very fucked up.
It's mind-blowing. And what's equally fucked up is the mindset that we're kind of trained into as working class people. Because I remember as a youngster, there were certain places that we'd go. On the way back, we'd drive a different route to go past all the amazing houses.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not driving past angry or furious that these houses, that there's so much more wealth just around the corner. We're driving past going, oh, isn't it wonderful? Look at all these amazing houses. And we should have been angry. We should have been going, oh man, then we get to our street and there's a homeless guy outside the Tesco's who I see all the time. And there's yet on the way home, we've gone past this street upon street of millionaires.
One of the tricks that capitalism plays on people's minds in Britain, in the UK and in Ireland, is it teaches people that you're not poor, you're just a millionaire that hasn't happened yet.
America was the best at it. The American dream was one of the best bits of marketing ever made. Yeah. Exactly that. It's it's made us not resent
temporarily poor,
because that could be us soon. At some point, that'll be me. Therefore, it's okay and it's acceptable, rather than acknowledging the structures that mean it's probably never going to be you. And even if it is you, it's temporary. It's not going to be that that long term. Yeah. A rich versus wealthy type.
So what have we got after March? April? I don't remember these months.
Yeah, again, there's not much. There's Biden beat Bernie to the Democratic seat.
Disappointing. Predictable.
Yeah.
That's one of those ones. You're just going, democracy isn't real in America. Like, clearly Bernie Sanders was the right choice.
Yeah.
You know, if the Democrats are supposed to be the party that represent, we said, the middle class of America or people who are poor in America, Bernie Sanders was the right choice, and you just go, no, he's not, because they want to maintain the same fucking power structures, and Bernie might be a little bit too radical.
Yeah, yeah. America was the first nation to report 2,000 deaths in a day. Again, I think we can all agree that they handled it. America and England, I think, handled it.
And Brazil, man, Brazil.
Were the shining examples of the bad handling. And Brazil. Yeah.
Brazil really fucked up too.
Well, in May, just jumping forward into May, because I think it's a really important point that I hope doesn't get overlooked in this mad year. Because again, I said at the start, what we're probably going to talk about is the election and the coronavirus.
Mm-hmm.
Even me, who'd made these notes, completely forgot to mention the killing of George Floyd and everything that that came as a result of it. The positive and the negative, but the positive for me was seeing the unity and the outrage across classes, across communities, and the outrage not remaining on social media. For a long, long time, outrage has been fenced into social media, and there's been amazing hashtags and movements.
Mm-hmm.
The Me Too movement comes to mind that existed on social media and had genuinely powerful impact, because it has started change in the film industry and things like that. And it's caused people like Harvey Weinstein to be locked up. But still, for most individuals, it existed on social media as a movement. And then lawyers, other people like that, could action it and take it on to the next step. Whereas the death of George Floyd and the resulting Black Lives Matter protests and vigils and all these other things brought so many people into the real world, and it felt that your outrage couldn't be contained to social media anymore. It wasn't enough. It clearly wasn't enough to be outraged on social media. So how was that from where you were, and what did you kind of see and think of it all, I guess?
Again, like, look, I'm in Ireland, so I have no context whatsoever for what it's like to be a black person in America and to face violence like that as part of everyday life. For the police in America not to be someone who helps you, but someone who can potentially kill you, even if you call them to help you, you know, I have no frame of reference for that. So for me, with a situation like that, I try and shut the fuck up and listen as much as I can, because I don't have a frame of reference for it, and listen to it. I think with America, anything, like, I often think about how racism was fed to me through American cinema, right, growing up.
Yeah.
And I look back at films, we'll say, like American History X, which I thought was, wow, isn't this a really good anti-racism film? Isn't this fantastic? Isn't this a good thing to like? And now, as I listen to more and more black people in Ireland, England and America speak about their experiences, I realise that films like American History X, I'm not saying they're harmful, but what they do is they make white people feel okay. They say to white people that being a racist means having a Nazi tattoo, having a shaved head, and outwardly using racial slurs and being a full-on Nazi. And as a kid, when I was watching it, I was going, yeah, I'm not a Nazi. I'm not a Nazi. I don't have a shaved head. I don't do that. And it's the buck at what a racism is stops at that point.
Yeah.
And then we'll say things like microaggressions, things like racist beliefs, the form of racism that's much more subtle, goes uncalled and unchecked. And then white people get to decide what a racist is. And our version of what a racist is, and I think in America too, it's classism. Yeah. Like in America, they would look at a skinhead Nazi and go, well, that person's white trash. Yeah. And I view myself as middle class. So, and the only difference is that that person will say a racist slur out loud in public, but I'll just say it at home in quiet.
But the racism
still exists. It's just they've decided which is socially acceptable racism and which is unclassy racism.
Yeah.
And the only way to find out about that stuff is when you listen to people who experience racism. You have to listen to people who experience microaggressions, who experience the subtle racism that I'm never going to see because I'm a white person. I'm never going to spot it. Yeah. I'll, like, as an Irish person, I'm privy to little bits of it if I'm in Britain. Like, I know what it feels like in Britain where someone just starts laughing at the way I pronounce words and little phrases like beyond the pale, which has anti-Irish sentiments going back 200 years. Right. As an Irish person,
I didn't even know that. Yeah,
like in the pale is the area around Dublin. Right. So historically, the English, like 500 years ago, the English had control of Dublin, but anything outside the pale was considered savage. So when someone says beyond the pale, what they're saying is that area beyond Dublin with all those savage Irish who can't be controlled. Wow. And I only really hear posh English people say it.
Yeah.
And then when I hear a posh English person say it, I'm like, wow, you got that from your granddad. And they got that from their great granddad. And their great granddad probably was in Ireland fucking killing Irish people. Yeah. So as an Irish person, you have a tiny, tiny little insight into what's called microaggressions. But when you listen to black people or Asian people and they talk about the little things, the little signals, that the small racisms that they experience in their lives that I can't see at all, that's the stuff that when you talk about it moving out of social media and becoming part of a wider conversation, that's what I have my ears open for.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not looking for where are the blatant white supremacists that I was warned about in American History X.
Yeah.
It's where is the racism that I could be doing in my life that I'm not even fucking aware of? Do you know what I'm saying?
Oh, that was the key thing there, was the comfort of looking at yourself openly.
Yeah.
And weirdly, trying not to be too judgmental of yourself. I know that sounds so prissy and careful, but trying to go, right, no, look, because if you're too judgmental of yourself, then you won't accept it. You won't accept that you've had things that you need to correct. You'll go, all right.
Exactly.
Well, that was wrong. Yeah. That was an error. So, yeah, I think that's a really interesting thing. And the thing I found as well was realizing that you can't just walk away from social media and go, oh, my job's done.
Exactly.
I felt it was a case of going, I did a podcast with a professor and a doctor who were both experts on the kind of things around the defund the police movement.
Mm-hmm.
And the point of that podcast was, I was like, right, I want to talk about this and discuss it and understand it more rather than just go, I've seen a couple of posts about it.
There you
go. And I agree. But the couple of posts I saw about it, even those changed my view of what it was.
Yeah.
So surely I should talk to someone more than just read a couple of posts and go, oh, I thought there's one thing. Turns out it's this. If I've learned that in three scrolls of an Instagram post, there's probably a lot more as well that I can learn and take in and understand. And therefore, a lot more that others can learn and take in and understand.
Because if you don't come from a community where the police are dangerous to you, where they are not protecting you, then a phrase like defund the police, you're just not going to understand it.
No.
You know what I mean? Like, how can I understand what defund the police means to someone living in the south side of Chicago when I don't... In Ireland, the police are there to protect me. Do you know what I mean? I don't come from a marginalised community in Ireland where the police are a threat to me, you know? So when you say defund the police, I'm like, it sounds like, what? Get rid of the police? Why would you do that? Whereas in reality, it's like, no, what is referred to as policing right now, that's not policing at all. That's institutional violence on communities who are at the bottom of the institution.
Yeah. One of the best examples that made things clear, or got it through clearly to me, of showing the difference in the experiences I've had, even though they haven't been ideal with the the police over the years, but completely different societally, where someone just said, I saw it online and I used it in that podcast. No one's ever written a song called Fuck the Fire Brigade, or no one's ever written a song called Fuck the Paramedics, because the paramedics and the fire brigade are generally seen as this amazing service. If the police is on a sliding scale of that, even to be polite about it, then there's something wrong.
Yeah.
And it just it summed it up so simply and beautifully. It's like, all right, you think of the police, the fire brigade and the ambulance service as three together, the three emergency services, yet one clearly stands out here. Which of these is not like the other, kind of thing? And it's, it's a mad one.
Yeah, I think with that, like, whenever I get asked what that, my response always, I just say, I'm listening. I try and listen if I can. Like, and not just in America. We'll say, in Ireland, we'll say the Irish travelling community in Ireland, they get police brutality. And then black and brown people in England as well, you know? There was that Stephen Lawrence stuff in London ages ago, the London riots. It's all the same systemic problem, you know?
Yeah, completely. I was about to make a point off the back of that as well, but it's completely gone.
I hope my vape isn't too loud, man.
The point was to say that it's also the important thing is realising it's not over. We very much build, because we like rewards and pats on the head, we've built a goal-based society. So what people could mistakenly think here is, right, America has got rid of Trump, done. But as you said, Biden and Kamala Harris aren't the answer. You can look and say...
Especially look at Kamala Harris's fucking... Her history within prisons, man, that's really
bad
shit.
Exactly, the police force and prison, her history is terrible. Yeah. You could look and say, we've got a black... Or they've got a black female vice president. That's amazing. But it's like, yep, but let's look further than that and go, it's a black female vice president that has done a lot to damage those exact communities that we were talking about who have bad relationships with the police and with the prison system. So there's more work to be done. And I think it's weird.
I think Biden's just there. Biden makes people who aren't marginalised feel good at nighttime so that we're not worried. That's what Biden's going to do. But if you're a marginalised person, I mean, I'd like to know what's going to happen with... Okay, so when Trump did get into power, he massively funded ICE. You know, he really did put a lot of funding into being quite aggressive with immigrants in America.
Yeah.
And he definitely did that. And they had a campaign of deliberately finding people who are right-wing leaning to become ICE officers. Mm-hmm. Is Biden going to roll back the ICE thing now, you know? Are we going to have children in cages, children separated from their parents under Biden?
Yeah.
I haven't heard him say anything about that, you know?
No. And to be clear, anyone, I wonder, ICE is essentially the immigration service.
Control enforcement,
Control enforcement.
Which flourished under Trump.
Yeah, 100%. Well, just as we mentioned, the kind of the goal-based gamification of society, how do you feel about that continued thing? Because I was thinking about it the other day. I think social media changed it a lot because we've gamified our lives in that we want likes. It's the Mario gold coins and now likes and retweets. But I went out for a walk last night. And again, I like to pop on a podcast and go for an evening walk.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to just enjoy walking. But now I'm checking my steps. And I'm clocking my steps. And it's this continued, we've turned ourselves into characters in the game. I still enjoy the walk, I think, but I can't help but go, I'll get to the end of the day and go, do I want a walk? Or am I just going, I've not had many steps today? And again, it's a positive thing in the long run because it's good to be active.
In the long run, yes.
But it's a weird, fucking scary thing.
So the problem isn't the process. The problem is the gamification. Like, I tell you what, man. So I do that. I go for my run. And I have my Fitbit, but before I had a Fitbit, I used to just use my phone. And I remember going for a run and I forgot to press the button that recorded the run. And then when I came home, having done a fucking 10-kilometer run, I didn't feel as if it had happened because I hadn't recorded it. And I had an empty feeling and the feeling of accomplishment was gone.
That's interesting because out here, I've started running because I've not got, there's obviously a pandemic, there's no gyms, so on and so forth. But one of the things I've tried to do on my run is not time them. Because again, in reality, I know if I'm pushing myself. I know if I've taken it easy. And sometimes I need to take it easy.
Listening to your body.
Listen to my body. And a mate of mine who's got into to running recently heard I'd been running and asked for my times. And I was like, I think I'm doing this much in roughly an hour, or trying to get under an hour, I think. But that's more from just glancing at my phone as I press play on the playlist. It's not from actually tracking it.
You will probably stay running and enjoying it longer because you're doing that, because you have to enjoy the process. If it's all, like, I've gotten to a point now, so I monitor my sleep, and it's a good thing. I like that I have a Fitbit and I can get a report on how well I'm sleeping.
Yeah.
But now I wake up in the morning and I go, right, how many hours did I actually sleep? And I'm trying to beat my targets with sleep. The one fucking escape is sleep. I can't go on Twitter when I'm asleep. But now I'm gamifying my sleep. You know, it's tough because that's what the human animal is. The human animal requires rewards consistently and continually. And the only way around it is mindfulness. Like, for you to go for a run and to decide I'm not, you know, monitoring it, that you've made a mindful decision right there to go, no, I'm going to stay in my body. If I'm exerting myself, if I'm breathing heavily, I'm doing a good job, fuck that, I'm going to concentrate on the run.
Yeah, exactly that. But again, I know it's been a conscious choice.
And do you listen to podcasts when you're running, do you?
I don't at the moment. No, I'm listening to music again. Like when I used to run,
I used to listen
to podcasts because I felt with music gives me a get out point.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell myself in my head, I'll keep going until the end of this song, and then I need a breather. I need to walk for a bit. I'm tired. Mm. Whereas podcasts don't give me that. I have to just say, right, I'm going to stop.
You find yourself stopping.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what I do is when I go to the gym to lift weights, then I will listen to a podcast. And when I run, I listen to music.
Yeah. One thing I wanted to talk about, and again, we're not going to go through everything in every month. So there's probably a lot less time left in this conversation than it may feel like, as we're technically only in May. one of the things I wanted to talk to you about is the violence that came in these protests. And it's something that I struggled having conversations with people about online, because online is a tough place for nuance. And I'm not 100% against violence as a solution. I think it's sometimes it's a necessary solution. More often than less, it's understandable at the least. And a lot of that came from having a Carla on at one point and him talking through the amount of revolutions that have come from bloodshed, the amount of positive changes that needed bloodshed to happen. I mean, we spoke about the end of slavery. That didn't happen because Abraham Lincoln said, oh, it's all over now. It happened because of much bloodshed, and then much bloodshed had to continue after slavery technically ended, but was still, we've spoken about the police force. It was the birth of the police force. So what's your kind of outlook on that? Because I know you're big on history. So I know you will know that violence isn't always the answer. I'm not saying that at all, but sometimes it's a last resort that is a needed result.
So, okay, I'll talk on this, not from lived experience, but something that's more, would say, relevant to me, because I want to be, I can't speak for the experience of black people in America because I don't know it. But we'll say last week, right, Ireland is celebrating 100 years of independence for the 26 counties. So last week we had the 100 year anniversary of what was called the Kilmichael ambush in County Cork in Ireland.
Right.
And basically, and I did a podcast on this. So my grandfather, my two granduncles, they were, would have been about 19, this is 100 years ago. The events of the film Wind the Shakes the Barley.
I've never heard the term granduncle, by the way. It makes perfect sense. I understand it, but I've never heard it.
What do you call
it? I don't know. Great-uncle. I haven't really thought about it, I guess. I've never really
Your grandfather's brother.
Yeah, I guess my grandparents didn't have brothers or didn't have brothers I knew. It's a weird one. Just
granduncles and grandaunts.
I don't want to take you off track there, but that was
the film The Wind That Shakes the Barley by Ken Loach with Cillian Murphy is loosely based on my granddad and my granduncles and their friends in West Cork 100 years ago. It's about area and what happened. So we had this weird situation in Ireland where we don't know how to, I don't want to say celebrate, remember the Irish War of Independence 100 years ago. Like in Britain, people wear poppies and stuff like that. But we don't have that in Ireland because it means... My grandfather and granduncles were in the IRA, the Irish Republican Army.
Yeah.
And 100 years ago, in Cork, what they were living under was Winston Churchill had sent these British soldiers into Ireland known as the Black and Tans. We viewed these British soldiers as the SS. They conducted themselves the way that the SS would have conducted themselves. 1 week previously, 100 years ago, they had gone into a Croke Park. So just today in Ireland, we had the All-Ireland final for hurling, right, mm-hmm. which is an Irish national game. 100 years ago, 2 weeks ago, the All-Ireland final was on as well. And the Black and Tans, British soldiers, they went into the stadium, 60 of them, with guns, and they shot 80 members of the crowd and wow. killed 14, including children, for no reason other than wow. terrorism. And this isn't taught in British schools, but straight up terrorism on a civilian population. And Winston Churchill deliberately did this because he was like, let's send a force into Ireland that terrorised the people so that they then turn against any idea of independence. The thought of it. Churchill also did it in Kenya in the 50s with the Mau Mau Rebellion. But it's this concept of terrorise the population and then the idea of independence becomes impossible and terrifying. So my granddad, who was 19, he wasn't an ideologue. He was simply had seen his neighbours being shot dead. At that time in Cork, that the actual law, if any young man put his hands in his pockets, he was to be shot. That to even put your hands in your pockets, whatever it meant then, was you could be an enemy combatant, so you're to be shot. So my grandfather and 30 other of his friends, they shot 17 British officers in an ambush, in the Kilmichael ambush, and these were auxiliary kind of, they would have been World War One veterans, mercenaries as such, who were in Ireland for to get a lot of money to literally terrorise the population. So I'm left with this situation. How do I remember my granddad? Because I'm not really into violence and I'm not like up the rat or anything like that. But how do I remember that ambush that happened 100 years ago? And what I choose to do, I'm not filled up with a pride of like, well, hey, my granddad fought the great British Empire. What I do is I remember a sadness. Mm. I think to myself, isn't it very sad that my granddad, who was 19, who was a farmer, and his brothers had been put in such a terrible situation where they're watching their neighbours being shot dead, where they're watching their neighbours' houses being burnt out by a terrorist force, that they are now essentially forced to fight back and to take human lives because they have no choice. Yeah. So that's kind of where I have to go with it. It's like, I'm not wearing a poppy. I'm not remembering bravery. I'm remembering the sadness of, wouldn't have been nice if instead of my grandfather being in a situation where he's ambushing British soldiers at 19, instead that he just got to be a farmer and milk his cows.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? It's sad. Wow. So that's why when I see the protests in America and I see the anger of black people setting fire to businesses, or when I see the Black Panthers, I said this to Spike Lee when we weren't recording, in Ireland when we saw the Black Panthers used to terrify white people in America. They don't terrify Irish people, because when we see the Black Panthers, we understand that.
Yeah.
I see the Black Panthers and I go, that's my grandfather, that's the IRA. These people in their communities have been put into a situation where they must defend themselves or else they die. They become victims of a system that's against them. And I can do that.
Again, though, it's the community thing there, defend themselves and their community. It's saying,
exactly.
Am I one of the strongest or biggest, not just to defend myself, I have a responsibility to stand up against this.
Yeah. And it's a difficult conversation to have. And then as well, when I say it on my podcast and I have British listeners, because in Britain, like it's...
Or the mere mention of the IRA.
Exactly.
I don't think I've ever heard it referred to as the Irish Republican Army. Do you know what I mean? Because that humanises it. That takes it out of this boogeyman term of the IRA.
That's what it is. And like the crazy thing is the memorial down in West Cork that's there for the Kilmichael ambush, what the stone says is Command Post West Cork IRA Brigade at 1920, 28th of November, and And on this road too died 17 terrorist officers of the British Army. Wow. Because it's not as black and white. And I can also say this while being utterly abhorred by, we'll say, IRA actions in England that would have, anything that targets a civilian population. So yeah, it's a complex situation for anyone. In the same way that I will get British soldiers mailing me saying, man, I'm doing humanitarian work.
Yeah.
You know, it's a real complex conversation, but I don't like dividing it into kind of into black and whites. So that's the context that I use when I'm trying to understand. I don't look at people rioting either on the streets of London or on the streets of America against a power that oppresses them. And I don't judge them. I say to myself, what a shame that they have been failed so many times by politicians, by structures of power. What a shame that initial attempts through peaceful means to get what they needed haven't been met. Because yeah, it's not about getting what they want, it's needs. My grandfather in West Cork 100 years ago, he didn't want to not be shot by British soldiers for putting his hands in his pockets. That's what you need. You need to not be shot by British soldiers.
Yeah.
And in somewhere like Derry in 1970, where Irish Catholics were marching for their human rights, and now all of a sudden the paratroopers decide to shoot a load of them because they're marching for civil rights in the 70s up in Derry.
Yeah.
Like, those people didn't want civil rights. They need it. If you're to live in a society, you need access. You need to be able to vote. You need to be able to do these things. Black people in America need to live in a community where they can be fucking safe to simply exist, and right now they don't have it. So if I see black people in America setting fire to a police car, I'm not fucking judging that. I understand where they're coming from, you know. Now, I don't, not my lived experience, because I grew up in Ireland, in independent Southern Ireland. People up in the north of Ireland, different story. They had British soldiers on their streets.
Yeah, it's madness. You mentioned a kind of a nuanced memorial there. It sounds amazing. Mm-hmm. It actually has stuff on there. In June, the Edward Colson statue was ripped down in Bristol and thrown in the water.
No, I'm 100% for that, man.
Me
fucking
too.
Rip the statues down. Apps, go for it. That's a statue, man. That's symbolism. That's iconoclasm. Go for it. Take down the statues.
It's something I noticed because I wanted to talk to you about. Because, again, people say, you shouldn't tear down statues because we should remember our history. It's like, statues have nothing to do with actual history. History can be learned in classes, but equally, I've sat in a pub in Dublin with you and a friend of yours and had a history lesson. You know, it can be learned socially in pubs.
The 2 a.m. Irish lads talking to the English lads saying, well, let us tell you what really happened.
It's fucking amazing. These are the places that history should live and can live.
Yeah.
It doesn't need to be celebrated in a statue. That statue isn't teaching anyone about the ills of the British Empire and the history that Britain has in slavery and all these other things. So
I think taking down statues, that's a really good way to direct anger, because it's frightening and symbolic to the powers that be, and blood isn't shed. I really like that stuff.
That's beautiful.
Personally, I think it's better that you simply remove the statue and put it somewhere else where it can be recontextualized, because some of the statues are beautiful as pieces of art.
Yeah.
Even if it's a beautiful piece of art about a bastard, always like, I don't like art being destroyed. So take the statue away. Don't worship it. Put it in the Museum of Cunts and go, here's some lovely statues of dickheads, and here's the things they did, and recontextualize it. But in Ireland, like, we have a huge history of that. Like, every street in Ireland used to be named after some British lord or British admiral. I mean, there used to be a statue of Queen Victoria in Dublin. Like, because Dublin, people have to remember, Dublin 100 years ago was Britain. It was under British rule.
Yeah.
So there was this huge statue of Queen Victoria. Now in Ireland, Queen Victoria, we call her the Famine Queen, because she was the Queen of England when the Irish famine was happening. So Ireland lost 2 million people in this famine, and most people in Ireland view it as an act of genocide on the Irish people, but we're not too fond of Queen Victoria. So how we got rid of Queen Victoria's statue is, a lot of Irish people in the 1840s, when the famine was happening, the whole population was starving, and what would happen is, if a starving Irish person was to steal some grain from a landlord, that's Irish person was sent to Australia as a penal colony. So it was it was quite similar to the prison industrial complex in America, whereby in America they have laws that deliberately target marginalized communities.
Yeah.
And then it becomes very easy for a marginalized person to end up in prison, but then the prisons earn money for having more prisoners, so it's this toxic system. So in the 1840s in Ireland it was quite similar. Britain was expanding its colonies in Australia, and it needed labour to do this. So if a starving Irish person did something as simple as steal grain or steal a pig, then fantastic, get onto a ship, fuck off to Australia, and you're never coming home. And they did it with a lot of English people too. A lot of poor English people were sent. That's why Australia is seen as the land that was founded by convicts.
Yeah,
it was the first prison industrial complex. So when we got rid of the statue of Queen Victoria around 1950, that statue that used to be in Dublin is actually now in Sydney. So, we sent her on a ship. Her statue did the same journey that Irish people had to do.
That's beautiful. And it's
symbolic. And it's a nice statue. So, the statue of Queen Victoria wasn't destroyed. It's just, we're Ireland. The Republic of Ireland is independent now. We don't want this statue anymore. Australia's in the Commonwealth. You can have her. And let's send her on the journey symbolically that many Irish people had to do under her rule. And now she sits in Queen Street, I think, in Sydney. Lovely statue, recontextualised. And the unionist people in Australia, some of them are happy to have him, some of them are not. But a statue wasn't destroyed, and it's a great symbolism. Iconoclasm, that's what that's called, when you destroy statues.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, a lot of these months is just going to be There's coronavirus stuff. But one of the things I wanted to talk to you about was the, albeit potentially brief, redistribution of respect to areas that previously had lost them, and whether that be the clapping of the NHS or the genuine respect that shop workers started to get in your supermarkets and stuff like that. The reason I wanted to mention it to you is I've mentioned it once or twice on here because, and I bastardised the history and the story in some way, but when I had Rutger Bregman on, I love his book, A Utopia for Realists. He spoke of when in New York, the garbage men went on strike, and within three or 4 days, the city fell apart. They bowed to all of the demands, and the garbage men became kind of known as the fourth emergency service. They now earn a good wage, and they have respect because it's a job that's actually needed. Whereas in Ireland, around the same time or a few years later, the bankers went on strike, and they remained on strike for many months, and then just kind of had to come back because the Irish people went. And again, it's mad that bankers are paid more than anyone, yet the garbage men, like, you'd see, like, I know as a kid that people would be like, the idea of growing up to be a bin man, that's disgusting.
That was
or growing up to work in a shop, even like even that, even
bin man or coal man.
Yeah. So how's that been in Ireland? Because again, that brief bit of history that in Ireland, as said, the bankers went on strike and the Irish kind of just made agreements amongst themselves. They kind of made people in the community, the banker.
We didn't put enough fucking bankers in jail, unfortunately. We needed to do that because they really did fuck over the country. But I mean, in both Ireland and the UK, I love seeing anything that respects workers. Like my mother worked in Dunn's, which is the equivalent to Tesco, when I was growing up, and she packed shelves, and she had to deal with rude customers and she had to deal with nice customers.
Underwear in Dunn's. I know when we'd tour, my guitarist would always stock up on underwear in Dunn's.
Today, I went in and bought 9 pairs of underpants in Dunn's.
Good underpants.
But I grew up with a respect for people who work in customer service and things like that. And anything, like, one thing that gets my goat in Ireland is the government love to blame young people around coronavirus. They love to say the young people are causing it. And then you go, well, isn't it the young people who are also working in shops? Isn't it the young people in their 20s who have to expose themselves to the public and work there every day? They're not necessarily just always partying. Yeah. So I'd like to think, I mean, retail workers are really going to come out quite fucking shittily as well after coronavirus, man, because, like, retail has been going. The past 10 years, high street retail has been going, and we've seen that because of the internet, and coronavirus has been the death knell of that. Like, what have we seen there in the past month gone? Jack and Jones.
Right.
ASOS. What's your man's name? Philip Green?
Yeah.
Every company that Philip Green owns, I think for the UK, it's worth something like 80,000 jobs. It's really, really big. But a lot of high street shops have gone.
I think it's given a lot of wealthy people like that a good excuse to cut things, because there's a lot of retail who have done better than ever online, yet, you know, can go, well, we're going to have to get rid of all of these people and not look like a cunt because of the coronavirus.
You're dead right, actually.
Particularly as the government, who have got a lot of friends like that, stopped mm-hmm. the furlough scheme for long mm-hmm. enough for loads of people to be made redundant, and then mm-hmm. brought the furlough scheme back to go, well, all these more high-end jobs, we're going to have to lock down again. We're going to have to bring the furlough back. So I think there's a lot of fucking shady, horrible behind-the-scenes shit there.
Most definitely.
Which happened within a few months of the virus. I think there was genuine panic from the governments around the world at first, and then there was, right, how can we spin this? How can we work this? The same as you said with 9/11. What can we get out of this?
Jamie Oliver got some flack for that, man.
Right.
Jamie Oliver got a bit of flack. Jamie closed all his Jamie's Italian restaurants quite early in coronavirus. And a lot of the critique that I saw was he didn't really need to do it. It's just Jamie's Italians weren't doing as well as he would have liked. And here's this perfect opportunity to shut it all down.
Yeah, because they'd been famously struggling for a while, hadn't they? Yeah.
Yeah. So, man, I tell you what's going to fascinate me is like, what is the world going to be like once coronavirus is gone? I reckon, now what the fuck do I know? But I'd say within 6 months' time, things are going to start feeling a bit normal again. Once they really start getting those vaccines out there, things will start to feel a bit normal. And there are positives of coronavirus. One thing for me, the environment, I think it's a good thing for the environment that a lot of people are not getting into their cars every morning and are not going to work.
And even more and so, not getting on planes.
Not getting on planes. Like, Jesus, man, you know, the job that you and I have, how many fucking meetings with agents are we being asked to get on a plane for?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, all the time, I'm like, can you fly to London? And I'm like, why? These three people in a production company want to meet you. And I'm saying, can we not just fucking do it over the phone? That's a big deal to go to London. And previously they were like, no. Meetings happen in person. It's just how it's done. But no one's going to ask me to get on a plane to London anymore.
Yeah.
No one is going to do it, because I'm just going to say Zoom. And they're going to go, oh yeah, we've done that. Let's do it on Zoom. Yeah.
We're now used to it. It's changed me on the podcast front. Like, I was against Zoom at the start of podcasts. I thankfully had a load backed up, and I was like, let's see how this goes. I'm not going to start recording. I'm going to have a few weeks off from recording any, because I'd rather, if we can get back to normal in a month or so, again, the ignorance of the start of this pandemic, if we can get back to normal in a month or so, I'd rather keep to doing them in person. But as soon as I got used to Zoom, it's great. It's no different. It is what it is, you know?
Not really. Yeah. Yeah, same with me. So there's all these positives that I hope. Now, then the negative of that is you wonder, will the employers then completely outsource the jobs and not keep their employees on board? Because if you do it remotely, maybe they can access economies whereby people are being exploited and working for fucking nothing.
Right, yeah.
You know, so there's that problem too. I mean, every time technology comes in, man, we need to have somebody updating rights. Like, I love the concept of a lot of human labor being replaced by robots, but we must tax the robots.
Yeah.
You know, like, within 2 years, we're going to be able to order pizzas and a drone's going to drop them into our back garden. That exists now already. It just hasn't really been rolled out. But I know, like, that's cool. I'll get it quicker. It's nice that a robot's delivering it, but there's a human cost. So, if we can get robots to do this shit, then a law needs to be brought in. It's still cheaper for the fucking employer, but you tax the fucking robots and that goes to universal basic income.
That
sounds like makes perfect sense to me. And then you've got people who don't want to do these jobs that they don't enjoy, but they're guaranteed a livable income and the robots are getting taxed. Why not?
Yeah, I love that. And again, like, universal basic income, it feels like something that people have finally starting to get more of an understanding of that it's not about old people are lazy and don't want to work. It's about people being able to have choices, to be able to do. An example, again, in Rutger Bregman's book was, if you've got two people going for an interview and one of them is hungry because he's not eaten today because he can't afford to, the other one is going to perform better. It's not laziness, it's just a level playing field. And most people, despite what Tories in particular will want you to believe, don't want to just sit around on their arse all day. I mean, we've seen that with the pandemic, the amount that people were kind of up in arms at having to just stay home, the amount of issues it's caused, because boredom is a quick thing to sink in. So
but I've even had, like, earlier in my career, I rely upon my creativity to earn a living. And at times in my career where I was really, really poor, if an opportunity came along, we'd say a TV opportunity, an opportunity to pitch my ideas, if getting this pitch meant this is how I pay my rent for 6 months, the pressure of getting this job was so great that the ideas I was putting forward were very safe.
Yeah,
I wasn't putting forward crazy, outside the box, adventurous, creative ideas. I was putting forward these really basic, boring things that everyone else was doing, and then actually not getting the job.
Yeah.
And then now, like, my income now is my Patreon. So my Patreon is basically a universal basic income. I know what I'm earning every time, and I'm chilled out. And I get to write crazy books. I'm on Twitch now doing musicals to video games. It doesn't really earn me a lot of money on Twitch, but it doesn't matter. I'm able to do my job as an artist, which is to fail. I'm able to search for failure, to do ridiculous things so that I have something that's rich. But if I was 100%, the next job, whatever I get next is what feeds me, I'm going to be doing all this really safe shit that's boring and not fun and not enjoyable.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I completely agree. I'll start to wrap things up then. Again, it was that kind of either we wrap things up now or push for another hour.
Cool.
And it's okay. Kind of that
thing. No, I definitely don't have another hour.
No, that's fine. That's fine. There's two things I want to touch upon then. It's basically, it's looking at the pandemic as a whole and looking at the negatives and the positives. The negative I wanted to discuss is the unignorable selfishness that we've seen. And I've been someone who's spoken for a long time that I think selfishness shouldn't be this dirty word. I think it's important at times for our mental health, for us as individuals, to be selfish, to think of ourselves above everyone else. But I felt like that's been thrown in my face, watching people swarm into beaches, watching people in uproar that the pubs have closed, and then as soon as they're open again, going and getting drunk and whatever else.
That's what you've described there as the, I 100% agree with you.
Yeah.
When you talk about selfishness, as in, sometimes we can find in ourselves in a situation where you're not even able to say no to people. If someone, but you need to say no, but you don't.
I've had that in the past with social events and other things where I've been like, I don't want to be here. And I know that this will take a toll on me for several days, but I don't want to say no. I don't want to say no because it'll be rude. And that's been a thing that's made me learn to go, no, if it's going to genuinely take a toll on you, then say no, have that selfishness.
So regarding my mental health, I am selfish with my mental health in that I put my mental health needs first.
Yeah.
Because if I don't, then I'm of no use to my community.
Yeah.
So by me looking after myself, and that means eating properly, exercising, taking time to myself, meeting my immediate needs, when I can do that, I'm a happy, functioning person. So I'm actually of use to the people around me. But if I put other people's needs first, that will take a toll on my mental health. And then I'm of no use to anybody. I'm not of service to my community. Yeah. So within that context, it's in psychology that's actually called responsible hedonism. To be hedonistic, but in a responsible way, where you meet your own needs first. Because to do so then means you can meet the needs of other people. It's like being on a fucking airplane, man. You know, what did they tell you when there's a crash? Don't put the mask on someone else. You got to put your own oxygen mask on first.
Yeah.
And then you get to your kid's oxygen mask. But if you look after them, you could both die.
Yeah.
You know?
I love that. That's beautiful. Well, I mean, the positives then that have come out of this,
Positives of coronavirus. What do you think? What positives are you seeing?
It's been some of the content. Again, I'm a fan of art. I'm a fan of entertainment. Mm-hmm. Again, I've said this numerous times. We shouldn't have to put the caveat of, obviously, it's not an overall positive thing. People have been dying all around the world. It's a horrific thing that's happened. But
yeah.
Things like Twitch, which you've kind of mm-hmm. done amazing things on. I've honestly, one of the biggest losses for me was when David Earl had to go and do his real job and make a film, because mm-hmm. I'd been watching him almost every day on Twitch, and just it's mm-hmm. that one that clicked with me, and the stuff that you do on there, Ian Lee, Richard Herring, Dan Lassac, mm-hmm. so many people have found ways, whether it be, so the thing that got me addicted on David Earl most recently was him playing FIFA, because he just mm-hmm. builds characters for every player. He'll write songs about the players he signed, all this kind mm-hmm. of thing. But you go on there and essentially freestyle musicals, or sometimes mm-hmm. chat. The times I've caught you has just been just chatting away. And it's great fun. So, yeah, how have you found things like that, I guess, the content that maybe wouldn't have come outside of these times?
It's changed my entire... So I'm old school. I started off with the Rubber Bandits more than 10 years ago. Yeah. And I started off, same as yourself, I don't think you or I have ever earned much money from actual sales of music.
No.
You know? Like, nor streams. So the only reliable source of income for a musician or an entertainer is gigs that you can bank on.
It's your hustle, and essentially, yeah.
That's the hustle, yeah. Yeah. And my main source of income for the podcast was doing all these gigs. And now that was completely taken away from me.
Because you did like a whole world tour with the podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Organised by a guy in Vancouver. Because me and him were talking about
I did all
stuff.
Over the
An
gaff,
Irish
man.
Guy was
I
in
did
Vancouver
fucking,
now.
Yeah, I did Canada, fucking Australia. I was supposed to do Asia. I did the UK. And
he hit me up about doing similar. And I looked and went, I'm going to see how this goes for Blind Boy first. I'm going to send him down the mine and then see if he comes out in one piece. Because this was a guy I'd never met, just hit me up out of nowhere and was like, I want to book a world tour for your podcast. I was like, all right, let's calm down.
I think he just did Canada, but I had different all over the gaff. But like,
love it.
I'm not going to be doing as many gigs. I'll tell you that. Once coronavirus becomes, once it's gone,
yeah,
I don't think I'm going to be gigging as much anymore. I've shown myself that I'm happier doing my thing online, looking at different ways to earn online. And I was doing so many gigs and so many tours because I was stuck in that loop. I was mm-hmm. stuck in the loop of 10 years ago, you can't earn from streaming, you can't earn from YouTube, so you can only earn from gigging. And now it's like, it's 2020. That's not necessarily the case.
Yeah.
There's things like Patreon. There's things like Twitch. There's all these different ways that you can earn streams of income. Because I don't like being on tour all the time. I love doing gigs that I enjoy, but I don't like continually going all over the place. It's stressful. And it doesn't help my creativity.
With Kay Tempest in the podcast that will come out before this, but as we're recording this, mm-hmm. it will come out next week. Because she spoke
like
about
you've
exactly
done tours,
that.
Man.
Yeah. Yeah, again, and it's exactly that. I loved every gig, which is a rare thing to get
the
to say.
The gigs
but
are
I
great.
Didn't love every
the
tour.
Bits around
yeah.
the gigs.
Yeah, it's
that's
everything
not
else
fun.
Around it. I always remember I still got it in a draft folder on my computer somewhere. I wrote a letter of resignation to Dan Lassac on our first American tour because the guilt I felt that I was living my dream. I was literally touring America, playing my music, and people were coming out.
Mm-hmm.
Yet I was absolutely miserable. I hated it.
And that doesn't help your writing, man.
And again, it was exactly that. The gigs, I loved every gig. That hour on stage, amazing. But that's 1 hour of your day. The rest of it was just. And again,
but
that's not the case. I've had tours I've loved as well, obviously. But
your job then as a creative, as a writer, mm-hmm. it becomes when you're stressed about being on tour. Now I do like my Australian tour that I did. I did that responsibly,
yeah.
as in. You know yourself, when you do a tour, you're off stage and then it's like, well, where's my reward? And then before you know it, you're drinking pints and then you're going to bed at 4 or 5 in the morning and then you have a hangover the next day and then you have to travel. And if you're not careful, that's a loop of just drinking and hangovers. So when I was in Australia, I was like, I'm not fucking drinking. What I'm doing is I'm doing my gig, I'm going to bed early, and I'm spending the next day exploring each new beautiful city that I'm in. And I loved it. I loved that. Beautiful. That's the best. That is the best.
When my Distraction Pieces book came out, I did a book tour, and I did it on my own. It was only around the UK, but I was driving myself every day, which meant I'm not going to drink.
And no drink,
it was one of the best things, because I'd either explore, as you said, or I'd go and see a film in the daytime. And
there
it was one of my favourite tours, because it was like, oh, this doesn't feel as if I'm here for the gig. It feels like I'm here and there happens to be a gig at the end of the day, but
there
that doesn't feel like the reason I'm here. Whereas tour always feels like the reason you're here is this big moment, and then you've got the build up and the come down. Whereas that tour was like, oh, part of my day is I'm going to stand up and talk to loads of people. But that's not the sole point.
So coronavirus has changed my entire attitude. So what I'm going to do, I'll probably do 50% less gigs after coronavirus, focus on online stuff. And what I want to start doing, man, is travel podcasts. Some of my favourite podcasts I've ever done have been one I recorded on like a street corner in San Francisco, because I happened to be gigging in San Francisco, and using like decent mics to do travel podcasts, to travel the world, maybe do a gig and deliver my podcast. And it's about my, because the problem with me is I have the fucking bag on my head.
Yeah.
So I can't like go to Thailand and walk around the streets with a bag on my head, because they don't know who fucking Blind Boy is. So, and I don't want to film myself without my bag.
Yeah.
But I can do an audio podcast of me just walking around talking. So I'm going to just embrace things more, and I'm going to chill the fuck out about gigs. There's other ways to earn a living, and it doesn't have to be gigging. And I shouldn't be doing a shit ton of gigs if it's not good for my mental health and my happiness. I should just do the gigs I'd like to do.
I love that. That's beautiful. And I'm 100% gate crashing one or two episodes of your travel podcast. Because again, that just sounds amazing. Just go somewhere and have that as the reason. I love it.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah. Well, thank you very much for your time, man. It's been
amazing. Thank you for having me on, man. It's been a pleasure.
And again, your podcast, your appearance on other podcasts and your streams and all sorts of things have been one of the key things in this weird time when we're trying to scramble for stuff that makes us feel normal. I said it's weird. I've got really into Twitch since being out here on my own in another country.
Yeah.
Because it gives you that familiarity. Like, genuinely, when David L. stopped, because he had to stop for a month or something to go and make a film, he's coming back soon, my mood dropped for a few days, because it had become my morning process of having a friend. Yeah, he was there for 2 hours or so as I'm having my breakfast, I'm getting on with stuff. It gave that familiarity, and it went. And I was like, oh man, that was one of my support devices. So I think we can't underestimate how important entertainment is, particularly at times like this, because they are our support devices. They are our, they can be our inspiration, our mood changes, our levels and balances. So, yeah, I appreciate that. And I'm excited for all that's ahead. I normally end by asking what's ahead. But number one, we don't know when this thing's ending. And number
two, I'm going writing a book, man. I'm writing another book.
Are you writing another book?
I'm going to write another book of short stories. I'm going to keep doing my Twitch thing. I'm writing a play. And I've got lots of stuff. I've got lots of stuff boiling away that don't require me to travel. You know, so
amazing. Have you got any desire to write like dramas or whatever for TV? Because you said you're looking at getting some of your short stories turned into things. Is there any desire to convert them yourself?
To be honest, when I write a short story, man, even though I write it as a short story, I write it as if it's on TV because my background is TV writing. So I write short stories as if they're on TV. So it's one and the same, really. It's just not written as a script, but I love it. I love writing. I love it.
I love it. Well, thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Nice one, Pip. Thanks for having me on, man.
Press stop now.
Okay. I'm pressing stop also.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That is it. This is my last words of the year to you guys. Once again, thank you to everyone who supported, but a huge thank you to Buddy Peace, the producer extraordinaire, to Jared, our boy Jared, who sorts out
the website uploads and all that kind of thing, so that you can listen to it on there or embed it or do whatever else. And John Harris, who runs the Distraction Pieces Network social media pages and does all them cool little quote videos. I mean, I'd love it if his quote video for this episode was this section about how great John Harris is, but we generally adore him at the Distraction Pieces Network. So big thanks to all three of those homies and to everyone on the network for putting out podcasts when they could in such a weird year. You know, there's always been a no pressure thing, and I've been as proud of two, three of the Distraction Pieces Network hosts. I've been as proud of them for not putting out podcasts when they really needed a break from it, or from making a change that they needed, because that can be as hard as anything. And looking out for your mental health and knowing your limits and when you're pushing yourself too far is hugely important. So big love to everyone on the Distraction Pieces Network. Shall I try and list them all? Jason Reed, Susie Gage, Bozzers. I still count Matt Richards and Jim Smallman, even though they've moved on to greener pastures. Dan Lissack, Brett Goldstein, Amy Ballman, Harry. I can't say, I don't know, I don't remember her surname. I know her name isn't even Harry, it's Ang Harrod. But Harry, Chris, and Stu. Flames Yarl / 76 / Stu Mangan as a producer extraordinaire on some of them. And Buddy Peace, a producer on a lot of them as well. I think I've said everyone. I've probably left someone off and it's hugely offensive. But who listens this far into a podcast, let alone this far into the year? Thank you for tuning in, guys. I will see you next week. As ever, you are beautiful. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.